hearings and possible work sessions today. Is Hans in the room? I'd like to start with Senator Kate Brown's bill, and she's delegated Hans Bernard to be here. Hans, I've already called your name. Get your body up here. And explain, I'm going to ask Judith to explain the bill briefly and then let you carry forth. And it looks like you've got one of the famous representatives from the good senator's district sitting beside you there. Go ahead, Judith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senate Bill 357 directs local governments to allow neighborhood associations at least 45 days to comment on the issuance or renewal of liquor licenses. It extends the time period for consideration of an application for the license, and it would apply to licenses up for renewal or issuance on or after the effective date. We have received a no revenue impact. We have not yet received word from fiscal on this measure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Hans, you want to hold forth, or are you going to let Representative Rosenbaum go first? Whichever you want to do. Great.
Thank you. Chair Shields, members of the Committee on General Government, for the record, my name is Hans Bernard. Senator Brown would like to send her regrets to the committee, but due to some unexpected scheduling issues, she has asked me to be here today to deliver comments on her behalf. Thank you for the opportunity to be here and share my support for Senate Bill 357. The bill before you today is a classic example of how the legislative process is supposed to work. This bill originated from conversations Senator Brown and her representatives had with constituents regarding the time allotted to neighborhood associations to comment on liquor license applications. Senate Bill 357 will simply change the time constraints currently placed on neighborhood associations and grant them an additional 15 days to provide comment. The bill will ensure that these groups have at least one meeting between the time that they are now given notice of an application and when they must submit written comment to the city. By passing Senate Bill 357, we will ensure that citizens have an appropriate time to comment on liquor licenses that are being applied for within their community. I thank you for the opportunity to testify today and ask that you welcome many of Senator Brown's constituents who are here to speak on behalf of this bill.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good to be back in front of you again. And I am Diane Rosenbaum, state representative for House District 42, and that is indeed one half of Senator Brown's district, so I can certainly second the comments that her staff just made. I'm testifying in support of Senate Bill 357, and truly this issue, probably almost more than any other issue, has been one that has been a constant source of stress and strain for a number of neighborhood folks in our districts. And it was an issue that was brought to our attention a while ago and again at a meeting that I attended just recently, just before session. So as was just said, the bill will extend the comment period on the issuance or renewal of liquor licenses. The current 30-day period really is difficult for neighborhood associations because they frequently meet only once a month. And so having this extra time would really allow them to notify their members through newsletters, general meetings, and community safety and livability meetings. All of those tend to take place only once a month. And since, as you know, these are volunteers who are working in their spare time to try to make this happen, it really is sometimes difficult for them to meet the timelines. It'll also allow time for neighborhood associations to work together in developing good neighbor agreements with local businesses. We think this really is a modest proposal to allow the input to go forward, and that really it's not too much for these folks to ask in a changing area that, such as Portland's East Side where we live. We need to be careful about balancing the growing business community with the livability of surrounding neighborhoods. So, in closing, I would urge the committee to pass this modest change to extend the time period for comment on liquor licenses so that we can give neighborhood associations an adequate amount of time to consider the applications so they can make judgments based on the values of their communities. I would urge your support for the bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Rosenbaum, some of the best neighborhood associations I've seen, some of the most active, have been in inner city southeast Portland, where they really struggle for the livability of those neighborhoods. I think they do a yeoman's job. I pastored a church in that area, and so I know them pretty well. Is this same concern reflected more broadly across the city of Portland and maybe in other cities as well, would you say?
I would assume that it is. I can only speak from my own experience directly, but I know a representative from the city of Portland here who might be in a better position to answer that question about the whole city, but I can only assume that it's a concern shared by others.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions? I'm going to let you both step by. We won't let Hans go too far in case we want to torture him a little bit before we let him go. But I'm going to ask several others that are on my list, and I'll just go through my list in order. Bill Perry and John Fire. Okay, why don't you both come up to talk for a minute. Bill, I'll let you carry on first, and then we'll go to John.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Perry with the Oregon Restaurant Association. I put neutral on the bill because I'm going to ask that we address some other issues along with this one. Last session, as most of you know, we extended the time period for neighborhood associations from 30 days to 45 days. One of the issues we have is with temporary licenses. Right now, off-premise, which are grocery stores, and on-premises that are a change of sales get a temporary license. But now, new on-premise does not get a temporary license. So the issue that my members are kind of stuck with is I open up a building, do the floor plan, hire employees, and then I've got to sit there and wait before I get my liquor license, which basically makes it almost impossible for me to conduct business or make any money. And then some days I sit there for 90 to 120 days. So the hardship of the neighborhood involvement is not a problem if I can get a temporary license. Asking these time periods to extend, I think it's important to get the input, but it just means it's longer and longer I have to wait before I can open my doors. So one of the things that we've asked the House Business Labor Committee to do is they've got a bill introduced right now with by the Oregon Liquor Control Commission that basically allows assesses an application fee of $400 for my new licensees and gives them a temporary permit. I have given them personally the language for this bill and asked that it be included in them because we obviously don't have any problems with the extended time period as long as we are granted a temporary license. I think, but asking these businesses to continue to not open even longer periods of times without an ability to operate is becoming too much of a hardship. So I'm not necessarily opposed to the time limits, but I think as of right now they're waiting up to 120 days, and if we push that limit out farther, it just places more and more of a hardship. So I would ask that we address this in 2056, which is an old CC bill that grants temporaries, would be my preference. And with that, I'd be more than happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, we've already been talking about the fact that pieces of this bill and others will go together. I understand that. I will probably be asking the OLCC to comment on your proposal after I hear some more testimony. Mm-hmm. Questions? Senator George.
Bill, I'm assuming that before a person would build that new facility in anticipation of a liquor license, that they would have made sure that they covered all the zoning issues. So they're moving on the assumption that this is a legal operation. Is that correct?
Senator George, Chair Shields, I would say that, and I would leave this open to the OLCC to answer, but generally for people to get through the application process and get moving on, I would say very, very few liquor licenses get declined. There are some, but not a lot. So most of them do move forward. So.
Okay. Follow-up question?
Yes.
Are you disturbed by the concept that this may enable a local neighborhood association to negotiate some sort of concessions from this legal business?
Senator George, Chair Shields. I would say most neighborhood associations will sit down and negotiate with the bar owner or tavern owner or restaurant owner to try to get some sort of a good neighbor agreement. And I think that happens a lot. I mean, obviously, I'm not going to sit here and tell you there aren't unreasonable bar owners and unreasonable neighborhood associations. They exist too. But I would say, from my experience, I think most of the people have been able to sit down and work out their differences. And, you know, like I said, there are a select few that are thrown in the hands of the OLCC and given a tough choice, but I would say most of them, a high percentage of them, work out their differences in a good neighbor agreement.
Thank you. Thank you. John, why don't you hold forth for a minute?
Okay, yes. My name is John Fire, and I represent Smile, Selwood, Moreland Improvement League, probably one of the oldest and we think the best neighborhood association. Yeah, represented a lot of Southeast Portland, like you stated there. I've been at it for about 15 years, been on the board for all that time, held offices over and over again, and still there. I'm also the wage and hour commissioner for the state of Oregon, one of the three. The time of the essence is very crucial here in neighborhood associations due to the fact that we are trying to get up to speed with I've implemented e-board information where as soon as we get the application, we email it to the board so we could be up to speed and ready to go when we have our meetings. But they're once a month. There's usually a general meeting and a board meeting, at you know, apart from each other. And in the past, it's been like this. A lot of times the request would come in and say, oh, yeah, good chance of getting this one even talked about because we're over the limits, you know, for whatever. It didn't cycle right at the right time. We would like to be ahead of the curve in, with respect to the gentleman here is in good neighbor agreements before the fact and not coming as an adversarial position after the fact where it causes a lot of problems. And so the tie could understand the issue here, but most of the parts in the neighborhood that I live in, we have probably 40 plus restaurants and license holders, so it's very we have a good stake in this effort here, and I think we're really requesting that the time, and I speak in favor of the bill, obviously. But it's important. We promote businesses first in our neighborhood because we're an integral part of it, and that's one of our basic tenets. And open meeting laws require that we post, and if there's any appeals or anything like that, that we have to go through. And so it makes it a little difficult to do that. We've had one incident where we really needed a site visitation, where Capriles had requested an extension of their liquor license to do some outside stuff. Well, we have enough people on the sidebar, basically, you know, that dispense different things, but it was... Once you visited the site, it's hidden. It's in a courtyard, so it's not visible from anything, and it wasn't a problem to the board. But we needed that time to get everybody together to go do it, and I think it would really lend itself to the good neighbor agreements. We've gone in the past where we've had to do battle with some on our gateway entrances to the neighborhood where we've had strip clubs and different things like that, which are governed by the OLCC. Had we been able to work out some good neighbor agreements before, it would have negated the picketing and the whole thing that we had to go through to do that. By and large, the most part, the liquor licenses just go through. They're innocuous. There's not a problem. There's just an owner change or something. But every once in a while, there is that requirement that we really need to look at and really take a good hard look at as far as a neighborhood association. And so we're behind this. It's just kind of a no-brainer thing. It would be just great to do.
Thanks. Any questions? Thank you. I'll let you both step back and ask that Kimberly come up. And let's see, I'm trying to read. Is that Celeste? Mm-hmm.
Did you say Celeste?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I have some.
Thank you for coming today. We're glad you're here.
Hi.
Since you're seated first, why don't you go first, Celeste?
Well, my name is Celeste Carey. I work with the Portland Office of Neighborhood Involvement. I'm Crime Prevention Program Coordinator for the Inner Northeast Neighborhoods. So to give you another geographical perspective, this would be most helpful. My job is perhaps the most micro of everyone. I am actually involved in a lot of the day-to-day activities of neighborhood associations trying to run their business. And that business with respect to alcohol serving establishments would be gathering what are volunteers, some of them grassroots, some of them more professional, helping them organize whatever information or process they want to have. At a meeting, for example, last night, we have a group that is considering another licensing. It's a change of ownership. The establishment proposes to have longer hours open and to bring new features in that might not be as welcome in that neighborhood if they did not have other crime-related issues. So we're looking at a neighborhood that is not an official alcohol impact area but has a lot of the similar concerns. This gives the people enough time to do whatever research they want to do, which would also mean working with the police timelines because it's not information on demand for them, to meet and to draft their proposal and then have a chance to sit down and have a proactive, cordial conversation with the new owners rather than to feel that it's an adversarial role. And when it's a short time, sometimes that time compression causes it to feel a little bit more of an adversarial, confrontational meeting than it should be. So just from the fact that I'm there on a day-to-day basis, I wanted to come in and support having more time for neighborhoods for the people to actually come together, because a lot of them are volunteers and it does take a little extra time. And sometimes I am a resource, but I may not be the only resource, and it's a matter of coordinating them.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? Mm-hmm. Kimberly?
Good afternoon, Chairman. I'm Kimberly Mark Biela, the City of Portland Liquor Licensing Notification Program Coordinator. I actually do the public notification process for the City of Portland in surrounding liquor license applications. Approximately, we have 2,030 applications within the City of Portland city limits right now. At any one time, we have anywhere from 20 to 30 licenses in process in an application status within neighborhood associations. And I'd like to support this bill in that it will give those neighborhood associations and other city agencies that are also involved in this process a good amount of time and to make an informed recommendation to OLCC on these licenses. When we receive the license applications, they apply at OLCC and they wait the application is reviewed and then returned to them approved, and they can take, at that point, OLCC does make a notification to the neighborhood association. I actually do the public notification within 300 feet and to the neighborhood coalitions, chairs, business associations, noise control office, and neighborhood response team officers, commanders of precincts. And that's a lot of people to try and, you know, get information returned from. That's a 30-day process right now, and that's actually cut short right now due to, budget cuts within the city. We're not filling some of the positions that are going vacant right now. So from the time a license is received from us, we actually have 3 to 5 days to send the notification out, and that cuts the 30 days. That's into that 30 days. The police bureau takes 15 days for the background investigation on the applicants, and their recommendation has to be reviewed by the chief of police and then forwarded to OLCC, and that's approximately 15 days for their process. So adding another 15 days to this process would actually be beneficial for the whole community in the city of Portland.
Now, those things happen at the same time. I mean, you're apprising neighborhood associations and others while the police are doing their background checks, so it's not as if one can't happen until the other's done.
Well, yes and no. I mean, when you're looking at, we have one full-time background investigator for 30 licenses in a month, maybe more. So that's, and each individual application, if it's a corporation, they could have 10 to 15 people listed as a person on that application. So they have to do a background investigation on each one of those people. And it does take a little bit of time.
Listening to the complexity of what you're asking, how did you guys arrive at 45 days for this bill? Was that the most you thought you could hope for, or?
The state allows us currently 45 days, but because it's so split up with the 30 and the 15, we had asked for the 60 days in hopes that it would give us just a little bit additional time to be more informed and make better recommendations.
Okay, thank you. Other questions? If there's not other questions, I'm going to let you step back and...
Thank you, sir.
I don't think we have anybody else that's asked to talk, but I do have a question. We have representatives of the OLCC here. I'd like one of you to come forward. I don't care who. Thank you very much. Before you leave, you pretty much heard my early question of Representative Rosenbaum, and you can comment, too. This is not just an inner city Southeast Portland.
No, sir, this is not. I'm actually in North.
Yeah, you're in North, and we heard from the Selwood area.
I actually cover the whole city of Portland for all of the notifications.
Okay.
And I work with 11 crime prevention specialists, 27 neighborhood response team officers, and 5 precinct commanders.
So it's pretty broadly based. The desire to make this change is pretty broadly based.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very
much.
Thank you, sir.
Chairman, we're going to give you 2 for the price of
you. That's great. Thank you. Thank you for the conversation this morning. I appreciated visiting with you.
Well.
I just wanted to ask real quick how you see all this tying in. Well, a few minutes ago, Bill Perry shared his thinking and was talking about tying this in with your bill and so on. What's your response to all that? I just kind of wanted that on the record.
Chairman Shield, I think it is very important that it be... I'm sorry, for the record, my name is Teresa Kaiser. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. In response to your question, Chairman, I believe it is important that both concepts go together. A good 90% of the new licensees we see would be better served by being in business promptly. Some may not be appropriate for that. They may be in a problem area, or the individual may have a criminal background that would not lend itself to a more prompt issuance. But we are troubled by delays in issuance of licenses. We do appreciate the involvement of the neighborhood associations in the city of Portland. There are many parts of the state where there's no interest at all in weighing in on liquor licenses, and that's a little bit troubling. So we welcome the input.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure there weren't any hidden concerns there. Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Part of this bill, obviously, we create a new paragraph in Section 9. I think it's the major thrust of the bill. But in the front page of the bill, we're also adding 15 days in a couple of places. Is it possible that the 45-day opportunity for a neighborhood association to provide comment could be, and this may be similar to a question that the chair asked, but could be folded into what we already have as timelines in the bill that the OLCC and local governments have to work through this process on?
Excuse me, Senator, I'm not sure I understood your question.
Well, I'll try again.
Okay.
The new paragraph 9 in the bill, a local government shall allow neighborhood associations at least 45 days to give notice for public comment, blah, blah, blah. In the front of the bill, you know, it has a 45 day that we're changing to 60 days, another part where it says 45 to 60, a place on the bill we're changing from 60 to 75 days. In those timelines that are already here, process through which as a public process, clearly those are longer than 45 days. Is that not enough time in the current number of days that we're working through this process for the neighborhood associations to weigh in on all of these liquor licenses, so that we don't need to make the additional changes, the additional 15 days in the other places in the statute.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Starr, my name is John Steubenville. I'm the Communications Director for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. I think, Senator, the point here really is, as I understand it, I think your question is sort of beyond the control of the OLCC and even the local government, in that it sort of goes right at the timelines for the neighborhood associations themselves, those sort of voluntary nonprofit type entities that typically meet once a month. And as I understand it, the concern there was to ensure that those very local entities had adequate time to review a liquor license application should they choose to do so. I mean, as we stand today, the OLCC notifies a local government entity of the liquor license renewal process well in advance of those actual renewal dates. But again, those timelines may or may not work with the neighborhood association entities. Does that sort of answer your question?
So, Mr. Chair.
Yes, go ahead.
I'm afraid I'm confusing this more than I ought to, but the question is, we're adding the Section 9 on the bill to provide 45 days for the neighborhood associations. I understand that. I think that's fine. But on the other portion of the bill, we're adding 15 days at various points, and that is just to accommodate the neighborhood association's 45 day process, I guess. Is that
actually, it seems somewhat separate to me. If I'm reading it wrong, and Judith, help me if I'm wrong, but it's just helping to facilitate the work of the application process by changing things from 45 to 60 days in a couple locations and 60 to 75 days in a couple other locations. Isn't that right?
Well, I mean, Mr. Chair and Senator Starr, I think the answer would be yes. I think that, again, I mean, you may want to ask the bill sponsor this question, but it seems the intent is to give, of those additional days, is to give the neighborhood associations adequate time.
For the purposes of the OLCC, if I could clarify, we would just on renewals issue the paperwork to the city earlier so that the licensee wouldn't be impacted. On all license applications except for the brand new licenses, we have the ability to issue temporary licenses to allow the business to operate while they work through this process. So the only one that really does concern me are the brand new applicants, but I think the other bill that the OLCC has sponsored would address that concern.
I had him here a minute ago, and like a fish, he got off my hook. I'm going to let Hans go at it here for a second.
Chair Shields.
After you've been around here for a while, you'll know that you shouldn't put more than one number at a time in front of a legislator, okay? let's do this 45-60, 45-70, 60-75 stuff and clarify it real quick.
Okay. Chair Shields, members of the committee, if I can help clarify. The intent of the bill was to give neighborhood associations 45 days to comment on an application. With that extension, the 15-day extension, we felt that it would be needed to add 15 days to the city so the city could then take into account the recommendation of the neighborhood association and then add additional time on to the OLCC timeline. So once there was an extension of one timeline, we bumped back the others so that the comments of the previous local group moving from the local level and the neighborhood associations to the city level to the OLCC could be accounted for as each are going forward with their recommendations.
Okay.
Does that clarify?
Now, do you have a question? Maybe
just one follow-up. Now, you're saying you're extending the comment period for neighborhood associations from 30 to 45 days, but I don't see that in the statute.
Correct.
I don't see a 30-day statutory ability for the neighborhood associations to comment.
Senator Shields, Senator
says 45 days.
As far as I understand at this point, it was the working policy of many of the cities to give neighborhood associations 35 days. So this would add a statutory clarification to that current practice.
Perfect.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator George, a quick question. We want to get more than one bill done today.
I think, yeah, we're going to have a little trouble. So the total time, though, is 75 days, potentially.
That's for the OLCC, not for...
Well, I mean, a combination of all of them, because what I'm going to get back to is this is a bill that deals with renewal also. Mm-hmm. And I'm worried about an existing business that may run into a 75-day twilight zone of their business operations. Reassure me that we're not going to have that happen.
John or Teresa, whichever.
Chairman Shields, Senator George, I can reassure you what we would do is issue to the city farther in advance of the expiration period the documentation so that they could weigh in and we could have it completed on time.
Okay. Is there any other questions or comments? Anybody else to testify on this bill? If not, I'm going to close this hearing on 357. I don't know if you guys want to stick around or not, though, because I want to open a hearing on 589, and I would like somebody maybe to explain it to me. Judith, do you want to start? And do we have, Gary, anybody signed up to testify on this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Senate Bill 589 requires the OLCC to approve training programs for persons employed by off-premises sales licensees. It provides that the licensee may require an employee to complete a training program if the licensee actually reimburses the employee for the cost of that program. It provides that it is an unlawful, this is a new unlawful employment practice, for the licensee to discharge, demote, suspend, or otherwise discriminate against an employee for making a sale to a minor if that employee has, in fact, not completed the training program. We have a no revenue impact statement. You have at your seat at the dais. The fiscal impact, which was just issued on this measure, and I will briefly point out, on the fiscal, you will see expenses, other fund expenses to OLCC, this biennium being nearly $98,000. For next biennium, that would drop to $91,300. The cost to the Bureau of Labor and Industries would be general fund dollars of $57,400. Biennium, $73,261 next biennium. The OLCC projects two positions would be needed, and that would be due to an increase in the participation in the responsible vendor program that would require these two positions. The Bureau of Labor Industry is asking for one position because they're estimating approximately they'd have to investigate 80 unlawful employment cases resulting from this new language. And one final thing I would like to point out is that the increase in expenses, legislative fiscal, indicates that it will result in a decrease in revenue distributions to the general fund by $54,873 in this biennium and a reduction in revenue to local governments of $43,115. That's our statement.
That's a long ways of saying that this is going to Ways and Means.
Yes.
That's what that is. Representative Rosenbaum, would you hold forth a few minutes?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. And I am Diane Rosenbaum, the state representative for House District 42, and am a chief sponsor together with Senator Bates of Senate Bill 589, and I'm appearing today to testify in support of this bill. The purpose of the bill at the bottom is to reduce alcohol sales to minors, and it accomplishes that by encouraging businesses to train their staff in alcohol and tobacco sales and protects clerks from being fired when they have not received such training. Senate Bill 589 will encourage businesses with off-premise liquor sales licenses to have their employees who sell alcoholic beverages trained by the OLCC Responsible Vendor Program. That's a training program that is already in place. Training these employees will decrease sales to minors, which is the purpose of the training, and there are members representatives of the OLCC that can talk to you a little more about the Responsible Vendor Program if you have questions about it. But this training is provided at no additional cost, and it can be completed in just 1.5 hours, and we think that it's really a good investment in reducing the sales to minors. Untrained grocery employees can inadvertently make the mistake of selling to minors. We know that this happens. It's, I'm sure, happened in your districts as well as I know it has in mine. Employers of employees who have been found to sell alcohol or tobacco to minors often terminate those employees for a first offense rather than permitting them to undergo the training that might have prevented that action from taking place. We don't think it's fair to fire or punish somebody for selling to a minor if they haven't been properly trained on how to identify minors and otherwise just the actions that they can take to prevent it. So the bill will protect employees from discharge or demotion for their first offense if they haven't already received the proper training. That's a pretty straightforward, that's really all the bill does. We think it's a common sense bill, not a new business requirement, but rather an incentive to have clerks properly trained in the sale of alcohol and tobacco. Those of you who were in the House in 2001 may find that this bill looks familiar because, in fact, an identical bill to this did pass out of committee. I believe, Senator Walker, you were on that committee. And in fact, it passed the House unanimously at that time. So we're hoping for a similarly favorable expression of support for the bill, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
When it passed the House, did it go to Ways and Means that time?
No. No, interestingly, it didn't. So I'm not quite sure what the difference is now.
I'd like to know. Wouldn't you like to know?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would. And this bill was ringing a bell with me as Representative Rosenbaum was testifying because it was in my committee. And I remember it had favorable treatment in the committee. But as so often the case, you don't know what happens to these bills a lot of times when they leave your chamber. So maybe we can get
How do I go about getting an answer to that question? Senator Starr, when you walked out of the room, I asked Representative Rosenbaum if this had a referral to Ways and Means last time. It's the exact same bill, and it didn't. It passed the House, and it didn't. Which year?
2001. You and I were both over here.
I mean, why didn't it have one then? And
a lot more money then?
A lot more money. I don't think so. I think I was here. As I recall, we had some money problems then, too. If there's one constant around here, it's money problems. I would like somebody to get me an answer to that. I mean, I'm in a funny position. Go ahead. You want to make a comment?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Legislative Fiscal did call me on this one to alert me that they initially had issued a minimal fiscal impact, but with the additional information from BOLI and OLCC, it puts us up over the $50,000 threshold impact, and since that's why they're recommending it goes to Ways and Means, because it does then bump us over the threshold.
Are they implying that BOLI and OLCC didn't do their job 4 years ago?
Inflation.
Oh, well. Representative Rosenbaum, can you work with this down in Ways and Means, you think?
I could certainly attempt that, because it does seem, Mr. Chair, it does seem perplexing to me, too, why it would have not required that referral, and now it does. I honestly don't know.
I wish somebody would really go on record as to why 4 years ago it didn't and now it does, and what the difference is if the bill is in fact the same bill.
It is. The bill was amended from its original version in committee, but this is the amended version of the bill as it passed out of committee.
Okay. Yeah. That's a question. We're not charging the basically grocery stores or. We're not charging them for this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Starr, the training is provided at no cost, so the only cost to them would be this small amount of time it takes for the employees to go through the training.
Any other questions or comments?
Well, Ms. Chair, I would just say that when this came to us in 2001, I had just freshly seen an employee at the local Albertson store in Eugene, long-time employee, very good, very fast, one of the fast checkers. I like going to his check stand. Anyway, he was fired just like that because he sold alcohol to a minor. First offense, he was gone.
And without training, probably.
Well, I don't know, but that was why, one of the reasons we saw that bill was because that had happened to other employees. And, you know, I just think we need to either provide training and give them some slack on their first offense. And the OLCC does have programs where they bring in those devices and make you check licenses and things like that. But it was a disappointment. He now works for another grocery store.
We have a couple more people signed up to testify, Steve Lanning and Steve Canopa. Are they here? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Steve Lanning with the Oregon AFL-CIO, and I have a representative with me from the United Food and Commercial Workers, which represents grocery clerks, among others, in the state. I was involved in the 01 session when we brought this original bill. The original bill that we brought to the House Commerce Committee was amended, so it was not a mandate. And we printed it word for word because it was not a mandate, and it was the bill that passed unanimously in the House that's before you now. It seemed to be the right kind of answer that folks were looking for. It wasn't an absolute requirement for businesses to comply with it, but it did protect employees, and that's what we're looking for, the protection of employees, as well as not providing alcohol to minors through sales. And as you can probably imagine, and my colleague will talk about it, what it's like, you've all been in grocery stores when it's real busy, and clerks have a split second to decide whether or not they're going to check this person or look at the ID a certain way. And I was surprised at the kind of training that's available when I took a look at it in 01 that really does work for something like this. I just want to point out that attached to my written testimony is a resolution from the Oregon AFL-CIO convention. The entire convention floor in the year 2000 took up this issue. We have approximately 400 delegates from all around the state, from all different kinds of unions. They took this issue up and actually passed a resolution on the convention floor to deal with this issue, because it's an issue of fairness and it's also an issue of training. And so I just wanted to attach that to let you know that it's been an issue for union folks and for United Food and Commercial Workers for a number of years. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? Appreciate your input, Steve.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Excuse me, I want to get comfortable here. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I think we're all on the same page. For the record, my name is Steve Canopa. I'm the United Food and Commercial Workers representative for the Salem area, which encompasses my territory as the Mid-Willamette Valley and Central Oregon. Our home office is in Tigard, and we represent the grocery store workers in Oregon, which approximately 17,000 members are indirectly affected by this bill that we represent. 10,000 directly are either cashiers or grocery clerks. I think we all want the same thing here. We're all on the same page. We don't want alcohol being sold to any minors. So we just want proper training for our workers who not knowingly may commit an act due to improper training at store level. There is training provided somewhat depending on who you talk to and which chain you talk to. I've witnessed it firsthand myself. I have 51 locations I service every 6 weeks. What I passed out for testimony is an example of a TAM program that UFCW purchased about 5 years ago. We have a tape that goes with that. It's an OLCC sanctioned program, and it's an example only of a program we'd like to see happen through this bill. One thing I'd like to point out, too, due to technology, the industry is more and more difficult. You know, retail is a pressure-packed situation anyway, and our grocery clerks, due to technology in the Fred Meyer stores and the Albertson stores specifically, are going through changes on remodels where you'll see a U-scan check stand now, where one checker is asked to monitor 4 and up to 8 units, which are actually mini cash registers. And I just like to point that out that, you know, they're professionals in their field, but you can bet that it's tough enough at one check stand to do the right thing on a 100% maintaining level. To monitor 4 to 8, you know, we just want to make sure they get the proper training. I don't want to go on and sound redundant. We're in favor of this bill.
Okay. Maybe I'm riding a hobby horse here too much, but you commented on this bill in 2001 and not needing the Ways and Means referral. And, you know, if I'm just trying to get something going here. If in fact this is a good bill, seems we send a lot of stuff to Ways and Means and it gets lost. What you said something originally, mandate and removing the mandate. Explain this a little more.
Senator Shields, when we had this bill introduced in the 01 session, the original bill said you have to train everybody. And after having discussions with members on the House Commerce Committee, they said it would have a better chance. It was not a mandate for business. So we made the modification. So if you don't train them, you can't discipline the employees for the first offense of unknowingly selling. That was the change that we made, and that is the bill that's here today.
And that's the bill that's here, but you said that change resulted in the no Ways and Means referral, potentially.
Well, Senator Shields, the bill never had a Ways and Means referral, and maybe it is the $50,000 threshold. Maybe the information they had at the time put it under the $50,000 threshold, but now it obviously is over.
Okay. Any questions? If not, I'm going to let you guys step back, and Bill Linden would like to come forward and speak on the bill. Mm-hmm. Bill, it looks like you have a shadow with you.
Mr. Chairman, for your record, Bill Linden representing 7-Eleven.
Okay.
And I've got comments on a couple different levels concerning this bill. In terms of the fiscal impact, you know, I'd strongly urge the committee to send this bill to Ways and Means where it can be considered within the whole range of funding issues that OLCC has. There's a lot of needs that hopefully are going to get addressed down there, and this one is one more that ought to be stacked up against the entire list. So I would urge you to move the bill in that direction if you're so inclined to move it at all. In terms of the substance of the bill, we have some concerns about what an impact it might have, and we think it may be an unintended impact. It's a reality that most off-premise stores, large, small, have training programs that they have been developing or are engaged in and that all their employees go through. For example, if you're a member of the Responsible Vendor Program, you've got to have a training component. That component has to be assessed by OLCC as adequate. And the real move in Oregon with off-premise establishments is to join the Responsible Vendor Program because of the advantages that were built into that statute for establishments to comply with those requirements. So, in a sense, I think this is an overlay that isn't really consistent with the Responsible Vendor Program. If the goal here is to encourage more off-premise establishments to join the Responsible Vendor Program, there are other things that possibly could be done short of this. Because two problems I see with this bill. Number one, clearly it interferes with an employer's authority to supervise their employees. It prohibits them from taking certain disciplinary action against employees that the employer may feel is appropriate. But secondly, and more importantly, I think, it would erode, and again, I don't think this is intended, but it would erode what is really the trend, again, with most off-premise establishments, and that's a complete zero-tolerance approach to sales to minors. If you do it and it's a mistake, you're finished. If you do it knowingly, you're finished. It's a zero tolerance. I know that that is our franchisees and our company stores, that's the policy that's implemented. It tends to really drive home to the sales staff the importance of always checking, always being careful, and always paying attention to what they're doing. And again, if you are giving them one free bite at the apple, I'm not sure that's going to have the effect that we all intended that we would move towards when we talked about the responsible vendor program and tightening up all the different factors that impact sales to minors. So I would urge you to think about that policy aspect of this bill and what, again, may be an unintended consequence of it.
Any questions? Is there a guy beside you there that's not signed up to testify named Rich of Wounded Station?
Thank you.
Go ahead, Rich.
Senator Shields, Richard Cosasan, Oregon Neighborhood Stores Association. I won't repeat a lot of the things Mr. Linden has identified. The members of the Neighborhood Stores Association have some fairly serious concerns with 589 as presented, specifically in the sense that they believe that it's inconsistent with the intent of the Responsible Vendor Program. If I recall, the Responsible Vendor Program started in 1999. It had two or three or four major goals, but primarily it was to enhance the training of off-premise clerks to assure that alcohol was not moved to minors. It was intended as an educational tool. It was intended as an enhancement for vendors, retailers to join the program, specifically for increased education training. But the bill as proposed is inconsistent with, the Responsible Vendor Program as constructed. Specifically, if you look at the measure on its face, the training of a retailer would be required to be approved by OLCC. And that requirement is not even found in the Responsible Vendor Program to date. If indeed a responsible vendor conducted their training on a very consistent basis, and that training was equal to or superior to the training provided through OLCC, but, quote, not approved by OLCC, and they had a clerk who inadvertently sold to a minor, under the bill they would basically be prohibited from sanctioning that employee. I don't think that's really the intent of the legislation, but I think that's how it's constructed. I also agree with Mr. Linden. I think in light of the requirements for OLCC to approve all the training courses and look at the potential for fair employment practices, I think you will have a fairly significant fiscal, and we should take a very hard look at that.
What's changed between 2001 and the present with regard to this bill?
Mr. Chairman, I'd honestly have to go back and take a look at the bill that actually came out of the committee in 2001.
I'm not asking the question so much related to Ways and Means as I'm asking the question related to the fact that this bill passed, I think it passed overwhelmingly in the House. And I'm assuming you were opposed in 2001, and yet the body then felt pretty strongly that potentially we needed to be thinking about forgiveness one time. I mean, these people are working very fast, under pressure. We're trying to reduce the amount of sales to minors, and yet you can have a very good clerk like the one Senator Walker referred to that makes one mistake, and no matter how many years they've been working, they're gone like that. training and forgiveness once seems not to be a counterproductive thing. I mean, and apparently that argument must have made some sense because the House passed this.
Senator, I can only speak for my particular client. I think between now and then, the zero tolerance standard has become more accepted and really entrenched in our culture and philosophy in terms of how we operate. And sales to minors, no matter what the circumstances, just simply are not tolerated. Whether it's the finest clerk we've got, or somebody who's you know 3 weeks into the job after the training, I think in terms of again our position, that is the biggest single factor that's changed in the last 4 years.
Are there other questions? Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a quick question related to the liability that your clients have in the event that they sell to minors. You want to just comment on that as a purpose, as a reason why the zero tolerance is
well,
been...
Mr. Chairman and Senator Starr, liability on two different levels at least. One is there are OLCC sanctions that can be imposed against a licensee for sales to minors. And those are monetary sanctions, but they can get up to the level of suspensions or even license rescissions. Then again, you have the whole sort of the outside sphere of liability where a sale to a minor in which, let's say that minor went out and was in some sort of an accident, somebody was injured, and that does unfortunately happen. So there is liability in that sense, potential liability in that sense as well. So we're very, very sensitive to it. I know we've had instances in some of our stores where it's been a very difficult decision to make to tell somebody on their first mistake that that's it. But you got to be. We feel you've got to be consistent, and the consistency sort of drives home the point of how important this is to our sales staff, at least.
Okay, Senator George.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I don't know what's in this room, but boy, when it hit us, it got us good. The bill also requires that if you should take this action after this bill's been passage, you would have committed an act of an unlawful employment practice. And it seems to me like it puts you really in a catch-22. You're going to get it either way here. And I'm trying to understand how a business responsibly would react to this. On one hand, you're supposed to be making sure your employees abide by the law. You have a liability issue in case they make a mistake and somebody gets involved in an accident. You have the requirement that your employees, in fact, obey the law. But on the other hand, if you take a disciplinary action, and it says, I found this, or otherwise discriminate against the employee. Now, I'm curious about what that means, but help me to understand this. This really, to me, puts an employer in harm's way.
Mr. Chair, may I, Mr. Lynch?
Please.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and Senator George, I think that's probably one of the cornerstones of concern associated with the measure. Again, if you had a retailer who has been in business for years and years and years and conducts their own training, and that training exceeds by just nearly everyone's expectations the training levels established by the OLCC itself, and that's clearly recognized, they have an employee who has been trained and retrained and retrained who makes a mistake. Carelessly, not carelessly, intentionally, not intentionally, but a mistake is made and a sale is made to a minor. If that training program is not fully sanctioned by OLCC, according to this bill, the employer basically has no cause to sanction that employee. And it really, really ties the hands of the employer in terms of the employer-employee relationship.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
I am not going to move this to Ways and Means today. I'd like an explanation as to what changed between 2001 and now. And Judith, I'm going to ask you to get somebody to come and explain themselves.
Okay.
And with that, I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 289. And let's go to a hearing on House Bill 2055.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House Bill 2055 also deals with the Liquor Control Commission. It allows applicants for alcohol service permits an additional 15 days, so it's extending it from 15 days to 30 days, to request a hearing for review of an OLCC decision to refuse an alcohol server permit, as long as it's a decision for any other reason other than for failure to complete an alcohol server education course and test. In that situation, it leaves it at a 15-day period of time to ask for a review of that decision. We have received a no fiscal and a no revenue impact on the measure. It passed out of the House. All members, 58 members present, voting aye. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
John, would you like to come forward? I hope this is the shortest one of the day. 58 to nothing on the House. You're the only one that wants to testify for it. It ought to be easy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. John Steubenvall, Communications Director for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. I can be very, very brief, Mr. Chair. Good bill should pass. would you like me to go on? under current statute, Mr. Chair and members, a person, an employee who sells or serves alcohol in a bar or restaurant must receive a service permit from the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Statute permits the OLCC to deny said service permit based on certain criminal histories. About 200 times in a given year, the OLCC will deny a service permit based on a criminal history check. In that situation, the applicant still has hearing rights, administrative hearing rights. Current statute gives the applicant 15 days to request an administrative hearing when denied a service permit based on a criminal history check. It's been our experience that in many cases, that's simply not enough time. What the bill simply would do is to extend the 30-day, the current 30-day time frame, I'm sorry, the current 15-day time frame to 30 days. That would allow the applicant enough time to request an administrative hearing, and that's what the bill does. Bill comes to you, pre-session filed, agency request bill. Certainly encourage you to move the bill today.
Okay, thank you.
Thank
Are
you.
There any questions? If not, I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2055 and open a work session on House Bill 2055. Anybody would like to give me a motion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Move 2055 to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Starr moves House Bill 2055 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Are there any questions? If not, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Jones?
Aye.
Senator Starr? Aye. Senator Berger? Senator Walker?
Aye.
Chair Shields?
Aye. And with that, House Bill 2055 is moved to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Anybody want to carry this little bill? Thank you for volunteering, Senator George.
He talks and he gives it to me.
That's right. Well, you know, we got to keep that voice of yours in training. Now we're going to open a hearing on House Bill 2214. And we'll get some testimony up here. I think there's some people that want to talk about this. And Judith, would you do a little bit of background for us?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House Bill 2214 modifies and makes technical corrections to the public contracting code that become operative, in fact, today. I can actually go through much more of the bill. Maybe you want to hear from the witnesses on that. We do have a no revenue and no fiscal impact on the measure. From the House floor, 11 people were absent, 41 aye votes, 7 no votes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I guess we can do it this way. We can get Dana Anderson to come up and Christine Hammond to come up. And we'll hear from a few others. And we'll learn a little bit about the bill. Okay? Go ahead. Welcome. We're glad you're here this afternoon.
Thank you, Chair Shields, members of the committee. My name is Dana Anderson. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Business Transaction Section of the Oregon Department of Justice, 1162 Court Street, Northeast, 797-310. I appear here today in support of House Bill 2214. It is a Department of Justice law improvement proposal. It does contain the technical amendments that were planned for the new public contracting code, which in fact becomes operative today. All three chapters of this new code replaced ORS Chapter 279, so we now have Chapters 279A, B, and C. And we have been in the process of writing model public contract rules on the state level and assisting other state agencies and local governments with their rule drafting. We knew going into that process that the several hundred page bill would have some technical glitches in it. We found a lot of them. And those corrections or technical modifications to make it work better that we could find by the pre-session filing date show up in the main House Bill 2214. We have been working with Legislative Council on Senate amendments to that measure, and I understand that that now is in their copy editing process, and within a few days that will be forwarded to your committee staff. So we would ask at that time that a subsequent hearing and work session be held on the Senate amendments. I worked with the co-chairs and the drafting committee on the ORS Chapter 279 rewrite process in 2002 and 2003, and then I coordinated the model public contract rule drafting process at DOJ. So during the course of that, I maintained a central log that state and local governments and industry representatives used to as placeholders for these technical amendments that were planned. And we have widely distributed those in the industry. Where there's been some objection in the industry, we've deleted proposals, or we've asked industry reps and those from state agencies to come to agreement on how they would change the language. So it's been a very open and inclusive process. Unless the committee wants me to, I won't go through the 15 or so bullet points that are listed here in my written testimony for House Bill 2214, but it does things such as designate what how state agencies go about designating personal service contracts. The code flips you back through several different statutes, but it never directly gives that authority, so it was just a technical error. We do things like allow submission of receipts of bids by electronic means in one of the chapters of the code for general goods and services, but not for public improvements, and that was an oversight, and so we corrected that. And so it goes on. We did have a late objection to one of the sections of the bill on allowing bonds for public improvement projects in less than 100% amount where it's a phase project, so you just supply the bonds to meet the phases that were then being let. But we did get a late objection from construction surety industry representatives, and so the Senate amendments will delete that provision. I have attached to my short written testimony a summary, a bullet summary of the proposed Senate amendments, so that you can see what they are as well. And if there's any questions on those items or something comes up during testimony of others, I'll be glad to respond to it. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to testify here today. I'll respond to any questions you might have.
Well, we've got 15 bullets to read, and it looks like another 10 proposed Senate amendments. All, I'm sure, very exciting stuff.
Well, if they were that exciting, I would actually go through them point by point, but maybe not that exciting.
Are there any questions? You better make it an exciting question.
Okay, I'll try to get it out. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. See, something came through this room, didn't it? There was some in the air ducts.
It got here when you got here. That's all.
No, I was fine. Under this bill, does DAS have the statutory authority to allow nonprofit acting as qualified rehab facilities to enter into cooperative procurement contracts or agreements?
I'm not the expert on cooperative procurement agreements, but I can tell you that the technical amendments don't change whatever that process is.
Okay, so we don't know whether the answer, I guess we need somebody from DAS here. Answer that.
I don't know if there's a representative. Yes, there is. So I think we can get you that answer.
Good. Could we get that on the record?
You want him up now? Come on up.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Dugan Petty. I'm the Deputy Administrator with the State Services Division of the Department of Administrative Services. Senator George's question, if I understand it, was does the Cooperative Purchasing Section govern the procurement of set-aside contracts under the 835 through 855 provisions of ORS 279, which is commonly known as the QRF programs or the disabled,
what?
The QRF qualified rehabilitation facility programs or products of the disabled, of individuals with disabilities. That section of law was not changed in this rewrite and was left in its entirety in 279. So if you look at the 279 section of the statute, those sections in 835 through 855 are left intact and left alone. Those sections allow for and require a product or service that is provided by a qualified rehabilitation facility to be purchased by a public agency under the set-aside program that's established under 835 through 855. So that section of statute, in my view, overrides the cooperative purchasing program, and that is to say that it is a complete set-aside and not subject to the competitive bidding requirements that are otherwise in statute.
In other words, as we discuss this bill, we're not discussing stuff that's brought to us quite often by the Fair Competition Alliance and so on. Is that what you're saying?
Well, Mr. Chairman, you could say that. I probably wouldn't say that myself. But that section of statute was completely left alone so as not to disturb anything that was currently in statute when this law passed in the last session. And so it has been preserved intact.
Okay.
If that answers the question, Mr. Chairman.
I think I understand what you said. I'm never quite sure sometimes with technical stuff. But if you want, we can have a quiet conversation at another time.
That'd be fine, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Maybe you could make contact with Judith and you and I could have a conversation about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Dana, any other comments you'd like to make?
No, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Jessica... from AGC, I'll give you a chance to hold forth. Dugan, you already had signed up. I didn't realize it. Did you have other things that you wanted to say in testimony? You can follow. You might as well come on up now and just sit here beside Jessica, okay?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to add our two cents this afternoon. For the record, my name is Jessica Harris-Adamson, and I'm here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors to testify in support of this bill. AGC was very involved with the passage of House Bill 2341 last session, which made these changes to the public contracting code and essentially wiped out what we currently have, with the exception of that one section that Dugan just talked about, and created this now three-part statute. We believe that these technical changes help make that law that you passed last session work better. It was our hope that we would be able to get this bill through before today, and ironically we're hearing this bill on the day that the new code goes into place, but making these changes will help that code work better and clarify the issues that, and certainly the intent of the law as it was drafted and as we work through it. So we appreciate the committee's consideration of this bill, and there have been a series of compromises that we've worked on all the way along, and have worked very hard to meet individuals' concerns and continue to do so as the amendments are drafted and as we present them to you, so that you don't have concerns, and this is a consensus product.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Dugan Petty again. The Department of Administrative Services participated in this rewrite going back over three interims. It is at least 6 years old, with the idea of making improvements in contracting practices. After a couple of interims and recommendations addressing low-hanging fruit, a work group actually headed by Representative Larry Wells sat down and decided that it was time to undertake a full rewrite of the statute. And through two interims, this work group worked very hard to do that. That resulted in a resolution, a House resolution, that actually sanctioned the final work group under Representative Girard's leadership. And it had three co-chairs. Jessica Harris was one. City of Portland had a co-chair working on it, and myself was a co-chair. And it undertook to hold agreements that were in place for construction in place and work where 100% consensus could be found under construction. And it undertook to provide really a clean sheet of paper to start with on the procurement for goods and services in areas where the system had not become responsive, had grown non-responsive over the years. So this effort was a major undertaking. It's an over 200-page bill, a substantial rewrite, and frankly, it's pretty amazing that we have as few changes to make as we do right now. About 18 months ago, the Department of Administrative Services undertook a complete rewrite of its rules to implement this law. Almost simultaneously with that, the Department of Justice began to implement their model rules. And as we went through the rule rewrite effort involving a broad group of stakeholders, these anomalies in the bill came up. We logged them, as the Department of Justice has testified, and that's what you have in front of you. So it is a good bill. We support it. We support this amendment, and we understand there's an amendment coming forward that should take care of the rest of the issues, and we'd urge your passage.
Thank you. Are there questions?
Thank you.
Yes.
Can I ask Judith a question? What was the vote on this in the House?
Okay. This one was the one that had the split vote. It had 41 aye votes, 7 no votes, 11 people excused off the floor that day.
Essentially 41-7. I've got two more people on my list, and then I'll get to you, Stephen. Sandra Bishop.
Thank you, Chair Shields, members of the committee. I'll make this blissfully short. I won't read the whole testimony. I'll just read a couple paragraphs out of it. It's in writing. For the record, my name is Sandra Bishop. I represent the Fair Competition Alliance. To clarify, we're not here to support or oppose this bill. We are neutral on it. We wanted to get clarification on one point, which I believe has already been clarified. I represent the Fair Competition Alliance, which is a nonprofit business trade association with both business and labor members, and we're interested in the public contracts that go without competitive bid to the nonprofits operating as QRFs, as Dugan Petty talked about, a qualified rehab facility. And we're just here to ask that the committee go on record to clarify that any corrections that are made in House Bill 2214 are not intended in any way to allow the nonprofits acting as QRFs or qualified rehab facilities under the Products of Disabled Law. This is ORS 279.835 through 279.855. We're asking that there be clarification that there's not intended that this bill allows those entities to enter into cooperative purchasing agreements or contracts of any kind. And the reason we're here today, and actually there's a section on page 4 of the bill, line 14 through, actually it's section 6, page 4, line 13 through 18 talks about the cooperative procurements. But after we heard the answer to Senator George's question, it's clear that this bill and its parent bill that it's trying to correct, House Bill 2341 from last session, do not change anything in the Products of Disabled Individuals Law, so it shouldn't be covered. But the reason I'm bringing this up is because there are cooperative procurement contracts and agreements being operated by nonprofits right now, and we believe that that's outside the statutory authority of DAS, but there doesn't appear to be anything being done with them, so we wanted to make sure that somehow they weren't inadvertently being included in this law. I'm going to give a specific example of that. It's the state mailing services contract with Garten. Garten is a nonprofit operating as a QRF and thus providing those services through a contract that was awarded without competitive bid through the Products of Disabled Individuals Law. This was originally a contract for processing only the state's mail. That contract has now been expanded to include at least a dozen other local governments, public entities, and state departments, so including the City of Salem, Marion County. So it's for automated mailing services, which have also, the products and services offered have also been expanded. But the problem is that in certain cases, if the nonprofit organizations are allowed to participate in these kind of cooperative purchasing agreements, there's a possibility for the complete sequestering of certain lines of business and industry in the state. And so that means they can take over an entire business line as far as providing that product or service for the state. So one example is the printing industry. If a nonprofit acting as a QRF is allowed to enter into a state cooperative purchasing agreement and provide printing services to all public entities in the state, that is certainly going to affect the marketplace. So that's why we're here, to get this clarified. So I appreciate your time, and I appreciate that you have had Dean and Petty clarify, and I'd be glad to answer any questions if you have. Thank you.
Thank you. Tim Kroll, could you come up and share for a few moments?
Thank you, Chair Shields. For the record, my name is Tim Kroll, and I'm Executive Director of the Oregon Rehabilitation Association. Our members are nonprofit community organizations that serve people with disabilities throughout the state. We really have no position on this bill. We think that the rewrite of 279 was long overdue, but our part of the bill was preserved in entirety last session, and I'm really not quite clear what the concerns of Sandra Bishop or the Fair Competition Alliance are. As she outlined, the bill Products of Disabled Individuals Law applies to public agencies, not just state agencies, but all public agencies. So in the example used, Garten's contract with the state, if public agencies also buy through the state, that applies to them as well. And this bill doesn't change that, and nothing in last session's bill changed that either. So I'm really not quite clear what...
Tim, I asked you to come up, and I know that was somewhat unfair because I heard Senator George's question, and I heard the response to the question originally, and then I heard the comments from the Fair Competition Alliance, and I just wanted to give you an opportunity to speak up on behalf of people with disabilities.
Oh, well, thank you, Senator. I guess just briefly, there are about 42 of these simply around the state. There are very few of them. You have to be nonprofit. You have to, 75% of direct labor must be provided by people with disabilities. This is, and the amount of public purchases that are provided by qualified rehabilitation facilities is far less than 1% of the public purchases. From our perspective, this is a vital program. It provides quality employment to about 5,000 people with disabilities, but in the broad scheme of public purchases, it is a very small percentage of public purchasing. And we believe there are almost 40-some states have similar laws. I mean, Oregon's law is comparable to others, and it's a marvelous program from our perspective.
Are there any questions?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Senator.
Thank you. I have a dear friend who runs a QRF who's been very concerned about the direction that this whole thing has taken, that we, in fact, do not have the 75% appearing in some of the operations. I think it's imperative. I'm just going to make a statement to you and ask you to respond to that. That this thing remain clean and pure and helping those disabled people that it's supposed to help, and not a mechanism to exploit them for other business activities. I would like you to have to tell me if you agree with that or...
Chair Shields, Representative George, we agree with it wholeheartedly. I know David Wiegand, the director of Mid-Valley. David is a person who holds strong opinions. He is the only QRF who has his particular view of how the program works, but the safeguards that are in place, for example, an annual letter of attestation from an independent CPA auditing firm that verifies the correct number of direct labor hours are involved, that verifies that the people with disabilities have certified disabilities. Oregon's law has the strongest checkpoints of any of the state laws. But I couldn't agree with you more. This is not a program to be abused by anybody, and we have no business protecting anybody who doesn't stick to the rules, nor do we think anybody currently is, but those safeguards that went into place are vital safeguards. We support them.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Stephen Cafori, he wanted to make a few comments on this bill as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Cafori. I'm here today representing Johnson Controls, Inc. I got here a little late and didn't get a chance to sign up, so I appreciate the courtesy of the chair allowing me to speak, and I'll be very brief. This company came to me early in the session and said they had a problem with the bill. It's a Fortune 500 company, and I'm working with one small portion of that company. And when you're working with some of these big ocean liners, sometimes it takes them a while to change their direction. I just received, just this morning, official authorization. I still haven't received it in writing to represent them, so I apologize that it's been taking us a while to get the contractual relationship worked out because of the levels of authority inside the company. Anyway, it finally has happened. We do have a problem with the bill, which I think we're going to present some amendments. And when I heard the earlier statement that they thought there'd be some amendments in a couple of days, I'm not sure when my amendments will be ready. I think it'll be longer than a couple of days, but perhaps within a week or so. And I would just ask the chair to wait until I have my amendments here so that I can bring them from the committee. Very briefly, what the section of Johnson Controls does that I'm involved with is energy retrofitting. And this is done on a non-bid basis, a negotiated fee basis. It's a very technical process of hiring people, and you want to make sure that you're getting people who are qualified to do the job, and at the same time make sure that the public is protected. And to make rules that allow both things to happen is not easy. As the rules are right now, they are more restrictive than is necessary and would require Johnson Controls and some other companies that do the same kind of work to cease doing work in Oregon, and I think it's to all our benefits to have as many folks as we can doing energy conservation work. So I would just ask you to hold on until I get my amendments, and I will get them as expeditiously as possible. And I'll work with, I've already talked to some of the people involved in this, and we'll continue to work with the other interested parties so that I'm not surprising anybody with what I'm bringing forth to the committee.
Yeah, and I particularly guess that you should be talking with Dana Anderson as you're proceeding forward. Is that agreeable?
I've already made contact, Mr. Senator.
Okay. Okay, just get him as fast as you can.
Thank you.
Okay. And with that, I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2214 and open a hearing on Senate Bill 191 and ask if Mike Currier would come forward to talk with us for a few minutes about it. Go ahead, Mike. Right now, my staff is on an errand for me. Can you explain the bill a little bit? I'll let you carry it from one end to the other here.
Sure. Thank you. Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Mike Currier, the Governor's Natural Resources Policy Director, and I'm here to express the Governor's support for Senate Bill 191, which extends the Sustainability Board to the year 2012. In addition, the bill would add two new members to the board who represent very important additions, a member representing agricultural landowners and a member representing private forest landowners. We think that those would be a nice complement to the existing representation on the board, which includes business, natural resources, community health, and economics. Well, under the leadership of Secretary of State Bill Bradbury, the board has shown quite a bit of leadership in the last 3 years, not only to state agencies, but to local government and the private sector. The board has crafted a vision. It's produced a couple of annual reports now showing the accomplishments made both inside state government and out. And it has a vision that we think extends to all spheres of Oregon's governance and business activity. And especially noteworthy has been the board's support for the development of an economic development strategy that promotes sustainability in business opportunities and lasting employment. Well, since its inception, the board's made great strides in changing the way government culture operates, we think in a very positive way, but it's also captured the attention of others. And that's why Senate Bill 191 is so important. And without the continued leadership of the board, we think that much of the sustainability benefits to Oregon, as well as the leadership position that Oregon has occupied in sustainability, would be lost. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
You know, if I, I'm not picking on you, okay? If I had some kind of disability and wasn't able to handle the word sustainability, I wouldn't understand your testimony at all. Can you describe what happens, what this board does, without using that word for a minute? And seriously. I'm trying to get you away from your notes to comment on
Mr. Chair, I'm not working from notes. I'm just working from the letter that I provided you, which I didn't need and tried to avoid reading for you. That is a common concern, Mr. Chair, about the notion of sustainability. Are we just repackaging the same old language that we've used for decades regarding conservation, energy efficiency, wise use, all that nomenclature? And the concept of sustainability is really one, and I'm sorry that I'm using the word, but what the board does is, first
of
all,
I'm going to fine him each time he uses the word sustainability for the rest of this conversation.
I'll step back, Mr. Chair, and get my checkbook here in a minute because I am sure I will need it. But what the board does is, first of all, it oversees the implementation of the governor's executive order on the S word.
On the S word.
Which directed a number of state agencies to undertake specific measures regarding business practices and natural resource conservation that met the goals of the order. Secondly, it provides a forum for people interested in the S word and other related conservation, energy efficiency, and innovative business practices that produce lasting benefits rather than short-term benefits. And I think that that's that forum that the board provides and the opportunity for the board not only to hear new thinking about conservation, energy efficiency, and other S-word subjects, but to export them throughout Oregon.
Okay. Now, I told you you couldn't use the S-word. I didn't say I couldn't.
Oh.
What you are then saying, if you would boil this bill down to one sentence, is that you're trying to get government and all of its operations to think about doing things in a sustainable way, and to kind of get that into the culture, the mindset. Would you say I'm very far off?
Mr. Chair, I think that you're right on, that the notion that we're talking about here is one in which we change the culture, the way both government and business operate, that we look at the practices that we engage in to ensure that they are not a continued drain on resources or practices that result in using up resources and or providing short-term gains over long-term and lasting benefits.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir. Senator George.
Those businesses who are a drain on these resources apparently affecting sustainability. Can you give me an example of those?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I'm not quite sure I understand the Senator's question in terms of which businesses represent a drain on resources. When I talk about, if I could make a stab at it, though, what I'm talking about is with regard to the state's investment in economic development or the efforts that the state promotes in economic development, is there a test that we're applying to ensure that those investments, that those, whether it's policy that we enact in terms of business law or direct dollars that we're investing in economic development, are they contributing to business opportunity and particularly jobs that will be around for the long term? And so I'm not pointing the finger at past business practices or specific components of the business sector and saying they've been doing it the wrong way. In fact, a number of them, for example, many in the forest industry, have figured it out for a long time that the only way to ensure lasting forest sector economic activity is through sustainable forest practices. And that's really one of the first places that sustainability arose.
Yeah, so I was taken on a tour through the Starker Forests, and boy, they use that word a lot, you know, and sometimes I have a hard time figuring out why the national forests cut at a rate of 1 to 12 board feet. You know, they have to grow 12 to cut 1, and the state is, they have to grow 3 to cut 1, and sustainable, in fact, is 1 to 1.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they talk about that, and they do a good job of thinking in terms of sustainability, because if they don't, they're going to be out of business. And what you're saying is you're taking this idea and trying to get others and trying to create a culture in which people think about things this way.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Did you have a question?
Yes,
okay.
Chair.
Go ahead. Senator,
I want to go back to this because it's the sustainability issue. We met with the governor's staff last fall when I was chairman of the Natural Resources Committee, and there were five people, three from the House and two of us from the Senate. We couldn't get a definition of what this is, but I want to ask you a question. You mentioned forest. A few years ago, I was holding hearings, and I had Jim Brown before the committee, and I said, Jim, we now have negative growth on the east side forest. That's correct, because of all the disease and insect problems. Now, because of Swiss needle casts and what's happening in the west side forest, we now have negative growth? And the answer is yes. And you know what that is? That's more trees dying than growing. And I ask him the question, at any time in the past when we were harvesting and we were culturing, taking care of our trees, and at any time before we went into preservation mode, did we ever have negative growth? And the answer was no. We didn't have negative growth until now. Now, what I want to know is, I want to make sure sustainability does provide sustainability and it doesn't result, for example, in forest issue in which we have more dying trees than growing trees.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I think that's an excellent observation, and I think we all have to share that commitment that whether it's natural resource policy or business policy in this state, that it doesn't result in that kind of a scenario. Absolutely. I would say that every person on the Sustainability Board would subscribe to that same philosophy you just expressed.
Are there any other questions? If there aren't any other questions, I'm going to close the... And just to recapitulate, all this does is two things. Right? It extends the sunset, and it increases membership from 8 members to 10.
Correct.
Okay? With that, I'm going to...
Mr. Chair,
yes.
It doesn't appropriate any additional money, correct?
No.
That's right.
No, it does not appropriate any additional money.
Okay.
With that, I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 191 and open a work session on Senate Bill 191. Can I have a motion, or do I need to make one myself, or what's the story here?
Mr. Chair, I'll make a motion to move Senate Bill 191 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Walker moves Senate Bill 191 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Those of the opinion that 191 should be reported to the floor with a due pass recommendation will vote aye, and those against will vote no. Would the clerk please call the roll?
No.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Berger?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Chair Shields?
Aye. Senate Bill 191, having received the majority of the votes required, is passed, and we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 191, and I'll carry the bill. And with that, I think we've finished our work today. I'm sorry it took so long. I was hoping to be out of here a half an hour ago. We're adjourned.
Your foot's better. You got that food on.
I went and got